Robert and Richard are certainly among those who have given back to their community. Each is a well-respected attorney, as well as published authors of noted historical works. Robert's a lawyer here in Charleston, and his practice focuses primarily on family law. When not involved in his law practice, he will likely be found studying and writing history books. He's authored 4 books on Southern history, including the Jewish Confederates. He's also a former Jewish Historical Society president and serves on the board of trustees of the Historic Charleston Foundation and is chairman of the Arts and History Commission of the City of Charleston. Richard Gerkel was nominated for a seat in the United States District Court for the District of South Carolina by President Obama in 2009 and was confirmed by the Senate in August of 2010. He now serves as a federal judge here in Charleston. He is also the first Jewish federal judge in our state, in our district. Prior to joining the court, Judge Gerkel was a practicing attorney in Columbia as well as a historian. He and his wife, Belinda, have authored many articles on South Carolina Jewish history as well as several books. Richard's also a former president of the Jewish Historical Society. Please join me in welcoming our 2 speakers.
Thank you. We thought a great way to open this conference on Jewish public service is to give a historic perspective and the profound roots of Jewish public service in the very earliest days of the Carolina colony, and to make clear that our present public servants are part of a great and quite noble tradition. So Robert and I have given several talks together over the years, and
that was before he was a federal judge. Now I have to be more polite.
Robert interrupts me constantly, as you can see, and I expect that. But we once gave a talk on at the Gibbs Museum on city Jews and country Jews, because you know the Jews of Charleston believe they're the only ones that count, right?
Which of course. There seems to be a lot of country Jews.
And the Jews of Charleston would refer to someone who lived 1 mile north of the city limits as a country Jew, right? And the country Jew was not a compliment, okay? So we would have a kind of banter about the accomplishments of the city Jews and the country Jews.
Which Richard was always on the losing side.
That's right. So there are some remarkable stories that Robert's going to primarily focus on the issue of public service in Charleston, public service in Charleston, which is really a remarkable story. And there's an equally remarkable story about Jewish public service and the largest other cities and towns of South Carolina and in the legislature that was really the greatest example of Jewish public service in early American history. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. Robert, tell the thing about the Louisiana Jews. They were commenting.
Oh, yeah. This is really funny. You know, the Charleston Jews, of course, in the colonial period, when we'll talk about some of that. But as time went on, you know, Beth Elohim, in a way, was a very large synagogue, and a lot of the people moved west. You know, Horace Greeley said, "Go west, young man." We don't think about that in relation to the South, but they did go west, and they went to Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. And one of the things I said in this brilliant book, Jewish Confederates, to talk about New Orleans in 1860, William Howard Russell, the author of My Diary, North and South, he wrote for the London Times. He wrote back, he says, "It is a strange country indeed," referring to Louisiana, which of course is a strange country. "One of the evils which afflicts the Louisianians," they say, "is the preponderance and influence of South Carolinian Jews." Not just Jews, South Carolinian Jews, especially land, and Jews generally, such as Edwin Warren Moise, Mordecai Josephs, and Judah Benjamin, and other. "The subtlety and keenness of the Caucasian intellect give men a high place among a people who admire ability and dexterity and are at the same time reckless of means and averse to labor." The governor is supposed to be somewhat under the influence of the Hebrews. Sounds like a Democratic Party.
But it was the U.S. Senator, the Speaker of the House, right, and the Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana in 1860 were all Charleston-born Jews and members of KKK.
And the federal judge.
It's a pretty remarkable story. But it was not really surprising when you know the story. Well, I think the first thing in terms of understanding how remarkable the Carolina colony and then South Carolina became for Jews is to appreciate the world they came from. The world, of course, South Carolina, to give you a little historic context, 1670 is the first settlement of the Carolina colony. And what were they coming from in the years, in the late 1600s into the 1700s? What kind of society did they come from? Well, this was old Europe. It was a very dark place for most Jews. There were strict laws that prevented Jews from owning property, from doing business with non-Jews, and residing in areas other than in the Jewish ghettos. And it wasn't just Jews who were discriminated against. French Huguenots, Quakers, Unitarians, Catholics. Basically, each country had an established church, and if you weren't part of that established church, you were economically and politically marginalized as a result. So, of course, we all know of the Inquisitions in Spain and Portugal, and so you had literally tens of thousands of Spanish and Portuguese Jews who were living secret lives as Jews. Moranos, they came to a name, they were called Moranos. And many of them immigrated to the New World to be able to practice their religion. In April 1775, right at the height of the sort of American independence movement, Pope Pius VI issued an edict prohibiting any Jew of Rome from being out of the city for even one night. The reside in the ghetto had to be home, and the gates of the ghetto closed in Rome. Jews in Frankfurt in the 1700s were confined to ghetto after dark. There was a tax placed in Dresden, Germany, on any goods, animals, or Jews passing through the gate. And Moses Mendelssohn was invited to speak in Dresden and refused to come because he didn't want to be taxed like an ox, as he described it. Jews in Austria in 1781 were required to wear identifying badges. And one Austrian synagogue was destroyed by the government after Jews threw out a minister who insisted on preaching the gospel on Yom Kippur. Now, this is at the era that South Carolina is becoming a haven for religious dissenters. This is what Jews were facing. And the other religious dissenters, the Quakers, the Unitarians, the French Huguenots, etc., were having very common experiences. Many point to England and Holland as places of greater tolerance, and they unquestionably were. But even there, Jews lived in particularized areas of town and were socially marginalized. So it's not surprising that these religious dissenters were eager recipients of inducements to come to the New World. They didn't like the old world. They economically had few opportunities, and they were not free. So the Carolina colony, the origin of that was sort of distinctly different from Maryland and Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, which were basically religious enterprises. Eight Lord Proprietors who had sided with Charles II in the restoration of Charles II to the throne after the execution of his father, Charles I, were rewarded with being given the Carolina colony, which is North Carolina and South Carolina. And it was a godforsaken place. Mosquitoes and Indians and unsettled, who would come here? And they said, well, we got to persuade people. Who would be the most likely people who we could induce to come to the New World? And religious dissenters seemed to be a very promising group, and Jews among those. And it so happened at the time there was a great deal of intellectual fervor around the idea of liberty and freedom and religious tolerance. And one of the Lord Proprietors, one of the eight, Lord Shaftesbury, was a particularly big advocate on the idea of the emerging ideas of freedom and tolerance. And he had as his secretary, who was the administrator of the colony, a young man who himself was a fervent believer in religious freedom. And this young man drafted the original colonial constitution. And it was a remarkable document of its time. Any seven people could form a church. Any seven. Before, you had one church that was authorized. Nobody else could do it. There was a prohibition in the constitution against disturbing any religious assembly or using any reviling language against any religion. That's just like unheard of, because those dissenters were always subject to that. And it provided for protection for what it said, heathens, Jews, and other dissenters. Robert once said that at least we made the top three. You know?
Yeah, I mean, we came behind heathens, but we were still on the list. And I want to agree with Richard. If you think about it, you know, we've heard this our whole lives, South Carolinians, that it was the Lord's proprietors. You know, well, the word proprietor means it's like a store owner, you know. Or so, you know, what South Carolina was a real estate deal and a real estate venture. The Lord's proprietors, mean they owned the land, and they were trying to sell it.
And they were trying to create a market, and they did it. But this young man who drafted this was John Locke, who ends up being the most remarkable political philosopher of his generation. Who would have known? He was a young man working as the secretary to the Lord Proprietors, and he drafts the first constitution in human history to religious freedom. It's a remarkable document. It comes in, it's not like the next day everybody showed up, because it didn't happen quite like that. But over the years, slowly but surely, these dissenter groups began showing up in Charleston. And they really define Charleston, don't they, Robert?
Yeah, and you know, one of the things we forget when we talk about Jewish history, a lot of times we take it out of the context of American history. Charleston is on the, you know, the western side of the winds that blow through the Caribbean, you know, so the Caribbean islands, Barbados, Jamaica, Haiti, all of these islands, there were Jewish communities. There were Jewish communities long before there were any in North America. And so these are Spanish-speaking Jews, these are Portuguese Jews, these are Brazil. There's all these things that happen, you know, before we happen. And Charleston comes along pretty late. I mean, 1670 for the Caribbean Basin is late. And so what happens is that the people coming to the colony from the Caribbean, many of them are Sephardic Jews. And that's what brings them to Charleston. So it's not like there's some big political movement. It's the fact that they are in Curacao, they're in
Barbados.
Domingo. Yeah, they're in Barbados, they're in Jamaica, they're in Brazil. They're in all these places where, you know, they're either not getting along with the English church, or they're not getting along with the Catholic church, or whatever. And, you know, so they come to Charleston. So Charleston then begins to attract people because of the political, the makeup.
They didn't care about what church you were. I mean, it wasn't like they were kind of indifferent to
it.
So for people who believed in their religious faith, no one interfered with them. So they were
unlike religious. Massachusetts. I always have to get this in because I one time gave this talk about Charleston. And I said that the Puritans were really fascist, and they ran everybody out. Some people from Boston got up and walked out. Well, maybe I shouldn't have said that. You know, but they were fascists. You know, they didn't let any, you know, you couldn't live in Boston. Not only you had to be a Protestant, but you had to be a Puritan, and you had to be a very young. And y'all remember Roger Williams left, formed Rhode Island. Well, the Jews couldn't live in Massachusetts. There was no synagogue in Boston until 1850. There's a congregation in Charleston in 1749. So there's a huge distinction.
Well, in addition, but in 1697, that's 27 years after the first settlers arrived, step foot, English settlers in Charleston, four Jews are made citizens, with about 55 French Huguenots made citizens of the colony. That is 43 years before Jews are citizens in England. They are, I mean, it is a remarkable, it's an emancipation that takes place, that transforms, and that begins setting the word out that this was a place you could do business. Now, some make the point that early in the 1700s, the Carolina Colony, of course, it becomes, they start governing themselves to some degree, and the church is established in 1704, and there are religious tests for running for office. So Jews would not have met that test. And I've had people say, well, you know, it must not have been much of a place for Jews. Well, let me say, in 1704, when the established church is made and these religious tests are adopted, no Jew had ever been elected to public office anywhere. It wasn't like you're losing something. What Jews were looking for was a place they could pray without the government interfering and open businesses. That's what they wanted. And Jews could own land, could engage in the professions, and could open a synagogue. And as Robert says, one of the earliest synagogues is KKBE in 1749.
Yeah, so starting in by 1740, there's a good-sized Jewish community. And as you all know, everybody in the room knows the history. Beth Elohim, the congregation, founded 1749. First building, 1791. I'm going to mess up. If I mess up, I'm sure I'm going to be corrected. And of course, they're very influenced by London Jewry, you know, not, I love the fact, we are a little snooty in Charleston, and the more I read about it, the snootier we get, because now, these are people from London. Well, that's the epicenter of the universe as far as I'm concerned, and, you know, so Beth Elohim is really a model of the great synagogue, Bevis Marks, in London, and the building looks like a church, but it's an Orthodox Sephardic congregation. A lot of people think Reformed Judaism somehow landed with Columbus, you know, but that's a later story. You know, these are Spanish speaking. The services are in Spanish and Hebrew.
Portuguese.
Well, you know, the way things are going now, maybe we can go back to that Spanish speaking thing, bring in some new members. You know, it's so funny how the Jewish aristocrats are Hispanics. You know, you never really quite think about that. The Sephardic Jews, yeah. So from there, you know, Charleston develops. I mean, there's a Hebrew Orphan Society, there's a Benevolent Society, there are all these things. And Jews become prominent in business and all sorts of things. And they're elected to all sorts of offices.
I mean, they're successful in business where Jews have to go, are being locked up in ghettos at night in Europe. I mean, they are prosperous and prominent members of their communities.
Right. And they're serving on boards, and they're serving in all kinds of capacities. So, you know, by the time of the Revolution, we had the Revolution.
I think you ought to talk about Francis Salvador a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Francis Salvador is a topic in and of itself, and many of you obviously know who Francis Salvador was. But what I think is interesting about him.
For people who might not, just basically who.
Y'all all know who Francis Salvador. Joseph Salvador was a businessman in England, and he had vast holdings. In fact, he was a member. He was on the board of the East India Company. So this is a very wealthy, prominent...
One of the wealthiest men in the world, basically.
Yeah, Sephardic family in London. He sends his nephew,
yes,
Francis Salvador, out to South Carolina to reclaim the family fortune.
But he buys 170,000 acres of land in upstate South Carolina, and it is known as the Jew's Land of South Carolina.
It's now Greenwood County.
Yes.
And Salvador, we don't know exactly, we don't know that much about him, really. We know that he was an aristocrat, we know that he was highly educated, we know that he was very respected by the aristocratic element and the upper classes in South Carolina. Now remember, he's an Englishman coming to make a living so he can make his fortune and go back to England, where he had a wife and children. But instead he settles in this, you know, godforsaken part of South Carolina. But at this time, there's all this agitation going on about liberty and about the British, and he joins the Patriot cause.
He becomes a revolutionary.
Becomes a revolutionary, which is, quite extraordinary. He then is a member of the South Carolina Provincial Congress in 1774.
Which, when he is elected, he is the first Jew in modern history elected to public office.
First Jew elected to anywhere in the world. And you know, you sit back and just think about that for a minute. 1774. And in Great Britain, which is a very liberal country, the Jews could not vote until 1848. We're not allowed to vote. It was called the Jew Bill. And, but here, this is sort of taken as a matter for granted.
And it's interesting. There's been a debate because there was a religious test oath.
Right.
They just didn't make him take it. They just let him take his office.
They just ignored it. So he's a member of the First and Second Provisional Congress. The journals of these congresses show that he's very, very active in the proceedings, as were John Rutledge, William Henry Drayton, Charles Coatsworth Pinckney, Edward Rutledge. If Salvador had lived, you know, who knows? Maybe he would have been at the Constitutional Convention, or maybe he would have been elected to some major office, because he was a very respected member of that group. The upstate, a lot of people don't realize, the American Revolution was a civil war as well as a war between the colonies and Great Britain. So the Tories, because after the war there were no Tories, you know, like after World War II there were no Nazis in Germany, you know. But in the American Revolution, in fact, there were a lot of Tories. And the Tories were, of course, trying to get the Indians on their side. And there's a big battle, and Salvador, who's a political prominent guy, jumps on his horse, you know, to go warn the other troops that this Indians are roaming around getting ready to attack. And he is attacked, he is shot and scalped. Now, this is a pretty bad way to die.
And he's the first Jew to die for the cause of America.
Yeah, he's the first, so he's a soldier, He's a political figure, and he's the first Jew to die for the cause of American liberty. And it kind of galls me a little bit. I know the American Jewish Museum in Philadelphia, they have a statue out there of Haim Salomon. A moneylender. Okay, we have a war hero. We have a war hero. So what I'd like to do is take Jaime, put him behind a museum, and put Francis Salvador up front. So if y'all have any influence, y'all let me know. He's a federal judge. He can't talk like that.
Well, you know, but then Jews began, and you know, post-revolution, right. New country, Jews began getting elected to public office in Charleston.
Right? Right, and you know, they're all over the place. In fact, many of y'all have read Hagee's book. And he says, in 1800, to the Civil War, Jews held numerous federal, state, and city-appointed jobs, master of the workhouse, clerk of court, clerk gouger, I don't know what that is, measurer, inspector at the customs house, justice of peace, constable, deputy sheriff, jailer, city guard, police warden, a lot of Jews in law enforcement, which, you know, you don't think of stereotypically, but they were. Magistrates, paymaster for the U.S. Army, treasurers, commissions of boards, orphan house, poorhouse, roads. In other words, they're really intimately involved in every aspect of life. They're elected. There's a Jewish member of the General Assembly as early as 1810.
Meyer Moses.
And then Lyon Levy was served in the state treasury office and was elected state treasurer in 1817. So, you know, starting very early, there are people...
I mean, remember, you know, Jews can't vote in England right now.
Right, they can't vote. But in South Carolina,
they're trying to hold these offices. And then, you know, South Carolina was always a legislative power state. The power vested primarily in the legislature, really until after the Civil War, the public did not elect the governor, the legislature did. So the power vested in the legislature, and Charleston was the most influential Senate seat in South Carolina.
Right, Charleston obviously was the most populous and the wealthiest part of South Carolina. And then, so we get to the story of Moses Cohen Mordecai. We say Mordecai. Ben Goldberg has convinced me that in the 1840s it was Mordecai.
I always want to know how he knows that.
Well, Ben was alive back then.
How does he know that?
I don't know how
he's corrected me 30 times. Yeah, how do you know that?
I don't know if he's right or not, but I'm not going to incur his wrath wherever he is. And so we'll just agree with that. Well, I think they did anglicize the name. But one thing that's interesting about Mordecai is that...
By the way, he's a state senator from Charleston and probably the most influential man in South Carolina public life in the 1840s.
Right. He's in the state house for 2 years in the House of Representatives, 1844 to 1855, in the state Senate, 1854 to 1857. Now, you have to say to yourself, and I find this utterly remarkable. Now, his house is right across the street from St. Michael's Church.
And next door to the federal courthouse.
Next to the federal courthouse.
Next to my office.
Beautiful house on Meeting Street. And in fact, when the South Carolina Jewish Historical Society was first formed, I prevailed on Sue and Bob Prenner, who own Ben Silver, so if y'all want to thank them, buy one of their ties. You can't get it wholesale, best I can tell. But they own that house, and we had a little party there in 1995.
It was great.
Yeah. And but here you have Moses Cohen Mordecai, and no one can really miss the fact that he's Jewish. I mean, really, you know, he's not trying to pass for Episcopalian. Right? And so,
and he's active in KKBE.
He's the president of a synagogue. I mean,
so and he's the state senator from Charleston.
From Charleston, and he's an ally of Calhoun. He's active in every part of politics. You know, I think he was not too much in favor of secession. He started a newspaper that was kind of mildly opposed to secession. But when the war comes, you know, this is how prominent a man we're talking. He owns a steamship line that runs ships from Charleston to Havana. So when it's time to, Anderson surrenders, y'all remember, April of 1861, and they've got to get Anderson's men off of Fort Sumter, Major Anderson, out to the federal fleet. So who do they get? They get Moses Mordecai's ship, the Isabel, named for his wife, Isabel Lyons. I'll let you brag about her.
Yes.
Well,
she's from someplace.
She's from Columbia.
Oh, Columbia, right.
By the way, I'm just waiting because I'm going to talk about the country Jews. You know, they think there's only Charleston here. You know.
Well, so he marries this poor girl from Columbia. At least brings her to Charleston, and she's from a very prominent family. So the steamship Isabel takes Anderson out to the Federal Fleet, a Jewish ship owner on a ship named for a Jewish woman.
And he's a very prominent gun runner he is a sort of hero of the Confederate cause. But it's not just in Charleston this sort of phenomenal public service is taking place. There in Sumter, Franklin Moses Sr., the son of Meyer Moses, the member of the House in 1810 from Charleston, is the state senator from Sumter. Chapman Levy, who owned a brick, was a lawyer of great prominence, owned a brick factory in Columbia, was elected from Kershaw County, Camden, and he was a very prominent unionist. In the city of Georgetown before the Civil War, three Jewish mayors. In Columbia, two Jewish mayors of Columbia before the Civil War. Jews owned city council as early as 1827. And Jews were, it wasn't just they were in public service. I think there were like six physicians in Columbia. Well, now like two of them are Jews. Jewish lawyers, they make up 30-40% of the bar. I mean, these are prominent people who are in all of these small towns. Philip Phillips, who is both Robert and I great admirers of, who was, we kind of know him as the greatest oral advocate before the Supreme Court of his time. And he had been the
author of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. He's born in Charleston to a poor family, marries into a very wealthy family, the Levy family, and becomes serves in the House from
Chesterfield County, of all places.
Yeah.
And then he goes to Alabama, and he becomes a member of the United States Congress, is a leader in
Mobile.
And he's a leader in Congress, and then he becomes the greatest advocate before the U.S. Supreme Court of his time.
I think he authored the bill to create the United States Court of Claims. Yeah, he sat and wrote the Kansas-Nebraska Act at the Treasury Department. He and Daniel Webster and a bunch of guys got together and smoked some cigars and wrote the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So, I mean, you know, these are really very impressive.
Yeah, and so you have, and then you have the coming of the Civil War. And Robert and I have obviously had many discussions about the Jewish role in the Confederacy, and it is one time I let Robert speak to this. Is it once said there was no place in 1860 in the world which Jews were more accepted than in the Southern states.
I think it's some truth to that. And the point of all this is, I think, is that the Jews also embraced their homeland. I think this was a two-way street. I don't think this was just South Carolinians were such wonderful liberal people. I think the Jews who came before us, and that's the point that I think is very important to make, they made a real effort to assimilate and to be a part of their community. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, I admire them greatly. You know, Gustavus Poznanski, who Richard in his essay in Belinda described as a rabbi, but he himself called himself Reverend Poznanski. You know, those Reformed Jews, you know, I don't think they use the word rabbi. And that was kind of a Jewish word, right? And but remember his great speech in 1844 when they're dedicating the temple. He says, "This synagogue is our temple. This city, meaning Charleston, our Jerusalem," which we still feel that way. "This happy land, our Palestine." And, you know, that's an anti-Zionist statement if there ever was one. I mean,
well, there wasn't a Zionist. Israel wasn't really in the sense.
But remember, the Jewish religion always, next year in Palestine, we were always in the diaspora, we were always wanting to go back. And, you know, one of the things about, I think, South Carolina Jewry, and I know in the Reform movement in particular, was, you know, we have given up that idea. We are not going back. We are not going back to Zion. This is our Zion. And I think that, you know, they embrace the community, and the community embrace them. And I feel very strongly that.
And it reflects, you know, one of the things that Robert and I were chatting earlier today about was that after the Civil War, there are these organizations that to memorialize the memory of those who had died in the Confederacy, who had fought in the Confederacy, and huge numbers of Confederate men died. It was a remarkable slaughter of people. I mean, the war was carnage. And these organizations, like the United Daughters of the Confederacy, Jews all across the country were active in those organizations. And my wife has written a good bit on this subject. And we sort of ask, why would that be so? What's your thought about that?
Right? Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, people, you know, when I wrote this book, Jewish Confederates, you know, the New York Times said, or one of the bloggers said, you know, what were they thinking? You know, but, you know, who knew, and this kind of stuff. But you know, these are not Jews from the Lower East Side. You know, these are German Jews, Spanish-speaking Jews, Sephardic Jews. These are Jews who have a conservative outlook on life. You know, we always identify the Jews with the liberal side of every debate because I would guess everybody in this room, with the exception of maybe one Moise or two, you know, our ancestors were Polish and Russian peasants. I don't know about yours, but, you know, in the case of the Rosens, that would be true. And so, you know, they were all communists, Bolsheviks, and various other things. But, you know, that wasn't necessarily true of the Jews who came from Germany and other places. So, you know, they were big believers in the established order. And so, you know, the idea...
They were loyal to home, wherever home was.
Loyal to their home. And there is a strain in Jewish thought, you know, to be loyal to the city wherein you live. There's, you know, there's some Jewish thought along those lines. So I think these were people who, not so much that they embraced the principles of the Confederacy, more they, look what they had. Look what they owed. You know, I know Dale talks about, you know, pledging allegiance in a portion of the people. Well, look what had happened. You know, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, them, their immediate families had come and found a very welcome place. So when the South seceded, I mean, what would have been surprising would have been if they had said, we're not going to serve. I mean, what kind of people would that be? So they wanted to show that they were loyal. They wanted to show that they were part of the community, and they did. And there's so many South Carolina Jews who were involved in the Civil War. We could spend a lot of time on that. But some of them, for example, the DeLeon family in Columbia, you know, there was a big debate in their family between, you know, Edward DeLeon and David DeLeon about whether they should secede or not. One of my favorite stories, David Camden DeLeon. You know, history, the Jews are just like the Italians and the Irish and everybody else. They all want everybody in their group to be good, virtuous, and prominent. They don't want to write about the bad people, you know. So Camden DeLeon in every history was always described as Surgeon General of the Confederacy. Well, he was. He was a drunk doctor who bumbled into this job for about 2 weeks.
If he was from Charleston, he'd left that drunk thing out.
Well, he moved. I think he moved to Columbia. That's what happened to him. But anyway, if you read Mary Chestnut's diary, which, by the way, Tom Hanks is making a television movie out of that. Mary Chestnut relates in her diary how Camden DeLeon made a pass at her, you know, and tried to, you know, put her in an awkward situation. So anyway, he was cashiered, you know, from the army. But we had so many prominent people from South Carolina, you know, who served in the war. We don't even have time to go into it. But, you know, some of the people I like, Theodore Cohn, whose son was August Cohn. That's a name y'all ought to remember. You know, he was in Orangeburg, and his father's up north, and he writes his son in German. I want to tell you my very desire that you leave this unhappy country, South Carolina.
Actually, I thought he was in Germany. He's telling him, I've gone to this country.
No, I think his father was in New York, okay. And I think Theodore had come down to work as well, I think, as soon as possible, because it will be ruined within a few years. I got you away from the old world, from the old Russ fatherland, so that you would not have to serve as a soldier slave for an unjust cause. For what? The Lord make your mind clear and lead you as soon as possible. Of course, he immediately enlisted in Company A, Haygood's 1st South Carolina Volunteers, also known as the Edisto Rifles. And, you know, so that's kind of what it was. I mean, they were at home. You know, they were at home, and they were fighting with their people. There's Isaac Lyons, Rachel Lyons' brother in Columbia. You know, there's Edwin Warren Moise, who was
a great aide to Wade Hampton. Yeah, who was a prominent general.
A Jewish member of the cavalry. I mean, who ever heard of such a thing, you know, leading a charge. Of course, the Moise family, they have what's called in history called rank creep. Rank creep means that your ancestor was really a private, but somehow he got to be a general. And family member. Well,
each telling you get better. But Edward Warren Moise was
Well, the family always called him a captain and then a general. But I mean, a major. But he actually was a captain. But anyway, but he was about to be promoted to major when the war ended.
And he became adjutant general of South Carolina.
He was a general.
Then he became general.
That's right.
known as the General.
That's the General. There's Colonel Abraham Charles Myers, the great-grandson of the first rabbi of Beth Elohim. After graduating from West Point, he became a career officer. He was a very smart guy. He married the General's daughter. And the General put him in charge of a fort on the west coast of Florida. And it was called Fort Myers, which is how Fort Myers, Florida got its name. And he was the quartermaster general of the Confederacy. So, you know, Meyer Treese, member of our congregation, you know, served in the Confederate Army. And millions, I mean,
thousands
of Jewish soldiers from around the South. And there were boys killed, you know, at the Battle of Secessionville. You know, in Charleston, we have this recreation of the Battle of Secessionville every year. We know there are two Jewish boys from Beth Elohim who were killed in that battle, you know, and they're buried at the Cumming Street Cemetery. So, moral of the story, they are part and parcel, you know, of the Confederacy.
But let's just talk a little bit about what happens after the Civil War, because the South is absolutely devastated economically, socially, et cetera, by the loss, and they've lost, you know, the total of human life is enormous. Economic life, obviously, this evil system of slavery has collapsed, and there's really not a system in place in terms of the economy. It's just in shambles. Well, Jews, you know, were people looking for opportunity, and some of the most talented, both Jews and non-Jews, left the South after the Civil War and migrated to the North and to places of greater opportunity. And there's unquestionably a decline in the quality of Jewish life in South Carolina in that era. KKB is barely holding on.
Right.
The synagogue in Columbia was burned in 1865. A new one was not established until 1895, when this new wave of immigrants, who were most of our relatives, which were these Eastern European and Russian Jews, came. So there's definitely a decline during this period from the Civil War into the late 19th century.
Well, Beth Elohim, during the Bob Barber in Charleston, the roof caved in, and you know, those Yankees were bombing us, folks. I mean, you know, I want y'all to know that.
Not that we didn't take the first shot.
Yeah, well, I just want y'all to know. Y'all
hear they shot me back, you know.
When y'all hear your Southern neighbors talk about the Yankees burning our towns down, they bombed your synagogues, okay? They burned your synagogues. So, I mean, don't feel so great about the Yankee troops. I mean, yeah.
But then, you know, so South Carolina, by the turn of the century, had this great tradition of Jewish acceptance and involvement in life. Some Jews remain, but nearly not the number or their prominence in business.
And then but we can't leave out Edwin Warren Moise and Reconstruction.
Right, but you know, he really, I mean, I don't want to leave him out because he is a very prominent guy, but he is a holdover from that past, that German, Jewish, prominent past, pre-Civil War past.
But key point here, when y'all read Reconstruction, more importantly, I don't even know if your grandchildren are learning history anymore. I don't think they even teach it in the schools, but to the extent they do teach it, Reconstruction is regarded as, you know, a great event where black folks took over the South and there was no corruption. All the carpetbaggers and all these people were wonderful people. As you can tell from my sarcasm, I do not agree with that. Edwin Warren Moise was Wade Hampton's right-hand man, and they were the Bourbons and the Redeemers, and they wrested away this corrupt government run by the carpetbaggers away from the bad guys and return it to the good guys. And Rich and I have always disagreed, and we'll always
fundamental disagreement
about Wade Hampton. But the point of this is that Moise is part of the Redeemer movement.
He's elected a statewide official in 1876 as the Adjutant General of South Carolina. He is a very prominent guy. There's a wonderful story of Moise. He was so beloved, he received a letter inviting him to become a member of the vestry of the Episcopal Church in Sumter. And he wrote back and he said, "I'm greatly honored by your confidence in me, but I'm a Hebrew. I can't join your vestry." You know, but it tells you something about the level of acceptance and involvement in their lives. But this new wave that came in the early 20th century confronted something as new immigrants that, you know, that reverberated. I used to hear it from my parents and my grandparents, and that, of course, was the story of the Leo Frank case. And for those of you who do not know the story, Leo Frank was a businessman in Atlanta who was accused, I think by all evidence falsely, of having killed an employee of his, and it created a public hysteria of the first order, and he was eventually lynched. And it was a story that dominated the news for about 2 years.
It was 1915.
Something like that. And it was it traumatized Southern Jews, particularly those new immigrants, in fear that this mob could turn on them at any moment. And it wasn't an insane thing. But, you know, Robert and I have talked about the Leo Frank case a lot, and it is an anomaly, actually, in the sort of the Southern experience. But it is nonetheless an important influence, but it didn't. There wasn't really any predecessor that was like it, and there really hasn't been anything since. But it was a very important historic event.
And I know Hollis is going to talk about this a little later. So, Hollis, is it 1915? Something
13.
Like, 1913. Well, this was a terrible event for Southern Jews and for Jews generally. And of course, no, I'm not trying to minimize it. But I will say that from 1913 to 1914, there was a member of the South Carolina House of Representatives by the name of Samuel Oscar Rittenberg, who you know as the person for whom Sam Rittenberg Boulevard is named. There's not one person in 100 who knows who Sam Rittenberg is. But Sam Rittenberg was a prominent member of the Jewish community. Henry, his son, has just passed away. And he served from 1913 to 1914. Then he didn't run. Maybe the Leo Frank case did have something to do with it. But in any event, he ran again in 1925 and served until 1932. He was chairman of the Charleston County Legislative Delegation. And I've tried to Google him. I've tried to get some information on him. The only thing I found was that he came up with a book to provide a law to provide free books to public school children in Charleston County. But I did. The internet is so amazing. I pull up a newspaper from the Spartanburg Herald from 1925. This is how random everything is. It says, Rittenberg introduced a resolution that would have legislators called Solons in the future instead of Solons, S-O-L-O-N-S, because they had overstayed their welcome. They had been in Solons.
But, you know, but that first generation, I mean, the Jewish office holding is, you have the Sam Rittenberg, and there's not a lot of them during this era. But then beginning in the 1920s, it's really the children of that first wave of immigrants mm-hmm. begin being involved in public service. And there are people like Solomon Blatt from Barnwell, South Carolina.
We might have said Solomon Blatt.
But
my grandmother was Annie Blatt.
Blatt.
But I guess they called it Blatt.
He was elected in the 20s, I think maybe 1928 or something, the legislature. And eventually, in a few years, he's the Speaker of the House, and he serves for 50 years as the Speaker of the South Carolina House, is the most powerful man in South Carolina. And his son, Saul Blatt Jr., is my colleague. He does raises an Episcopalian, is my dear friend and colleague, 91 years old now, still has an office in my courthouse. And we actually, yesterday, Judge Blatt and myself and Robert and his brother Richard took Morris, age 93, Robert's father, to the lunch. And it was absolutely fabulous. And I had a great picture of Judge Blatt and Morris talking to each other.
I said, Dad, Judge Blatt is still holding court. He said, Saul is 2 years younger than me.
But you have folks like Saul Blatt. You have folks like Julius Bubba Ness, who becomes the Chief Justice of the South Carolina Supreme Court. When I was growing up, my parents didn't sort of regard them as very actively Jewish, and they did not. They thought of themselves as Jewish, but the Jews, as my father would say, the Gentiles thought he was Jews, but they may not have thought they were Jews. But they did think they were Jews, and they didn't have synagogues. They didn't practice regularly, but they identified as Jews. The next wave that comes
after... Well, the important point here is Saul Blatt never converted to Christianity.
No, he did not.
And, his wife never converted. And, they lived in a small town. Judaism wasn't a big part of their life. But everybody in South Carolina knew he was Jewish. I mean, it was no secret. And so how is it, after Leo Frank, and this era, that, a man with the name of Solomon Blatt and, Julius B. Bubba Ness... are major figures in the
history. I mean, we have a Jewish speaker and a Jewish chief justice.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a sort of remarkable thing. And then you have a wave of very prominent Jews in public life. Isidore Lurie, who's the majority leader of the Senate. You have Max Heller, the mayor of Greenville, South Carolina, and an incredibly important figure. Arnie Goodstein down here, who's a House member and senator. Harriet Kiserling from Beaufort, who is the champion of environmental protection of the state. I mean, you have these incredible
and
figures.
Some lesser known people. For example, my cousin Nathan Rosen. How many of y'all knew he was in the state legislature for 3 years from 1942 to 1945? Well, the Rosens never quite made it that far. But anyway, he gave it a good shot.
But it's a remarkable, and you know, Robert and I were saying that somebody ought to try to figure out who were all those Jewish members of those small town councils and city councils, because they're everywhere. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'll be in a little town and I will discover that there was another a prominent Jewish merchant who was a member of their city council or a legislator or whatever, a mayor. I mean, it's a very common thing. And so I think a fair thing, as we're sort of wrapping up here, Robert, is to sort of, what is this about South Carolina? I mean, it's a little, if you come from somewhere else, you say they think they're Jews in South Carolina. And then the first question, and then, isn't it terrible there? And you go, no, you know, it's not. And it's completely counterintuitive, because the story is that though there are moments of anti-Semitism certainly present, and we can find them throughout our history, the general arch of the history is that this has been a place of incredible tolerance and inclusion. And in the face of the state's shameful history on race, why is it that Jews have had this remarkable experience?
And you know, and we can't say, we really don't want to paint this picture in rose-colored lenses. I mean, after all, when Max Heller ran for Congress, we all know that story. You know, Lee Atwater went out, you know, to put a candidate out there to let everybody know that there were certain candidates in the race who didn't believe in our Savior, Jesus Christ. So, you know, it's not like nothing bad ever happened, and that's not what we're saying. But, what we are saying is that, you know, Jews do have a remarkable history in the state. I know when I went off to college, people, you know, were you hiding in the basement, you know, anti-Semitism? I said, no, not really. We're really happily ensconced on our plantation. But 2 minutes? You're telling a federal judge? I mean, I can understand telling. Oh, you were pointing at me.
But it is a fair question, and you know, it seems to me that at least part of that answer is that people of faith in the South saw a certain authenticity in the Jewish people. You know, they were people of great value. They were hardworking. They were public. They were very devoted to their communities they lived in. They were white. I mean, they
were also conformists. I think that you can say during the civil rights era, you know, the Jews did not march with black folks. I mean, the merchants on King Street were sympathetic, but you know, so I think the Jews in South Carolina.
You know, one of the crises that occurred, it was sort of interesting in the '60s, was we had a lot of rabbis who came from other places in these southern communities who were understandably very sympathetic to the civil rights movement. And then you had these Jewish merchants who depended on trading with everybody in the community, didn't want Jews identified with the civil rights movement. Some of the most dynamic tensions in those small towns were between their rabbis and their these communities, because they were chameleons. They did not want to raise their head. They always understood. Maybe the lesson of the Leo Frank case was the Klan can turn on you in a dime. Mm-hmm. They may be persecuting and terrorizing black folks, but they can turn on you in a moment. So it certainly was a dominant sort of fear of Jews of that era. But telling the whole story, the arch of that story, the arch of the history, is that South Carolina has had this remarkable story. It's been a place of remarkable opportunity. And I think when we see a lot of places, you may have had Jews have a desire to serve, but did not have the opportunity to serve. Yeah.
So with that, we want to thank y'all for having us. And Richard and I have had a wonderful time. So I don't know about y'all. Thank you very much.
I'll be glad. Dale, let me turn it up. Edie was cutting us, giving us a note. But do we have, are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Just to follow up on your comments about England sending the undesirables here. I was sitting next to an Australian visitor last week in Manhattan at breakfast, and she thanked me for the American Revolution. She said, were it not for the Revolution, there would have been no Australia, because they then shifted to sending them there.
Well, write a letter to the various school boards, because I don't think they teach the American Revolution in the schools anymore, so it'd be a good
And let me say one thing, that Robert alluded to this. the connection between the Bevis Mark Synagogue in London and Charleston's KKBE was truly remarkable. And I did not appreciate it until Belinda and I were in London and went by Bevis Marks. Many of you know that there's a image, a very prominent image of the interior of the original building. Of course, it was burned in 1840. And we walked into the Bevis Mark Synagogue, and we were in literally the same building. That is, they built it to the inch, the same. They copied the synagogue. The first rabbis came from Bevis Marks to KKBE, and the first settlers to settle Jews were from Bevis Marks. They brought them to Charleston. Charleston was seen as a very important outbranch of the English
Jewish Charlestonians community. Always wanted to be Englishmen, and the Jews were no exception.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you. That was wonderful.